I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Would you like to live to be 120 years old? The Pew Research Center asked people whether they would undergo medical treatments to extend their life to 120, and a majority said no. While we all want to live a long and healthy life, living too long offers some worrisome prospects. In this hour of Radio Times, we're going to explore the attitudes and stereotypes around aging and old age. As life expectancy increases and the population ages, what are the effects on society and on culture? We have two guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studios is Susan Fiss. She's a professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton University, has conducted and published a wide number of studies on ageism with Mike North. And Susan Fiss, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
And on the telephone is S.J. Olshansky. He's a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Happy to be here.
And Jay Olshansky, let me begin with you. And I have to say, the more reading I did in preparation for this show, the less I understood what being old is. What is considered old these days?
Well, that's a good question. I suppose it depends on how old you are.
Exactly.
I remember being much younger. I'm currently 59, and I used to think that old was 30 or 40. 59, actually, I don't really feel any different than when I was in my 20s. So right now, actually, my only concept of old relates to my father, who was 96 when he died. And when he was 90, he actually didn't even feel like he was old. So generally, the general view among many is it's 10 years older than you are now, and with a rapidly aging population, whatever old is seems to be rising with the population. So our concepts of old and what old age are and what they mean seem to be changing with the times.
Do you see it that way, Susan Fiske?
I think that's true. I also think, and Jay probably knows this too, that there's a difference between the young old and the old old. And there are different policy issues and different stereotypes and different attitudes, I think.
And I guess and if we're going to use numbers here, the young old would be what, people in their 60s and 70s, the old old, 90s and more?
Yes, I would say that.
Actually, let me add, by the way.
Sure, go ahead.
There's the developmental psychologist who developed this idea of young old and old old, Bernice Newgarden, actually, believe it or not, was on my dissertation committee at the University of Chicago.
She's that old, right?
Yeah, she was wonderful. But one of the things she reminded me of was that the concept of young old and old old actually had little to do with age, your chronological age. There were people who were old in their 50s, she would say, and there are people who are young in their 90s. And so she actually was dismayed by the concept of young, old, old, and old, old being associated with chronological age.
Well,
just a reminder.
Sure. I'm looking at your faces, and you have a slightly quizzical look on your face.
No, that makes a lot of sense to me as well. I mean, there are different issues for people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and older, as we find in terms of the stereotypes. But I agree, a lot of it has to do with your vitality.
Sure. And I want to do stereotypes, but I want to toss something back to you, Jay, which is just looking in the last 100 years, the life expectancy in the United States at the turn of the century was almost 50 years old, and today it is 78. That is an extraordinary thing to happen within the span of 100 years.
Well, it's perhaps one of the most remarkable achievements of humanity. Raising life expectancy by 30 years in a decade was achieved largely by reducing early age mortality, by saving children, infants and children from dying from infectious diseases, and saving women from dying from maternal mortality. So we dramatically reduced early age mortality, and in return we got an extra 30 years of life. It was a remarkable achievement, to be sure. We're still benefiting from those early achievements, mostly from public health, by the way, not necessarily from medicine. In the latter part of the 20th century, medicine contributed to this as well. But, there was a Faustian trade associated with that. Now we get the privilege of living long enough to get heart disease, cancer, stroke, and Alzheimer's. So there was a price to pay for our extended lives.
But it does, I mean, it seems we seem to know more people that are into their 90s, well into their 90s, and maybe even into their 100s. I mean, that seems less unusual these days, Jay.
Yes. The rise of the centenarian population past 100 and supercentenarians past 110 has been absolutely remarkable in recent decades, and that will expand considerably just as a result of population aging, larger birth cohorts moving through the age structure push out the tails of the survival distribution. So you get a lot more older people. And what's interesting is you have to be careful about making assumptions about the elderly in the future based on what we see today. Mm-hmm. People who are much older today have been highly selected by conditions that existed in the 20th century, including a lot of people who smoked, by the way. So you tend to see a more, at some level, a more highly selected, healthier subgroup. And in the future, that may not be the case. Some people may make it out into older ages more frail and more disabled than what we see today. And on the other, the flip side, by the way, is that we'll probably see a lot more very healthy, exceptionally healthy, older people who really functionally, mentally, and physically aren't that much different than people decades younger.
Well, Susan, let me turn to you and ask you a couple of questions about the kind of research that you and Mike North have been doing on stereotyping and ageism. When we talk about stereotypes and old people, what are those stereotypes? What do people generally think about older people?
Well, what people generally think is mixed. It's a mixed bag. There's good news and bad news. The good news is that people think that old people are nice. The bad news is that people think old people are incompetent. So they're not taking account, by and large, of the highly able, you know, people who are continuing to be skilled and competent and go-getters.
Right. And does that apply equally to men and women, or is that complicate the picture?
That complicates the picture a little bit. We don't know as much about gender and old age as a sort of intersection.
But, I mean, it seems to me, when you think about discrimination applied to other people, when it comes to old people, generally we know old people. We know our grandmothers. We know our grandfathers. We know our elderly aunts and uncles. So it's an interesting – the stereotypes are interesting because they seem so personal in a way.
Well, that's a two-edged sword. So if you get groups of young people and old people, you know, generically together to try to get them to get along better – as compared to other types of in-group, out-group experiences, mm-hmm. this works less well because there is some there, and we can come back to that later. But the other side of this two-edged sword is that young people and old people are interdependent. We need each other. We're in the same families, but also in a society or at the workplace, there are younger people and older people. So it is different from many other in-group, out-group experiences mm-hmm. in that way.
But do you think young people and families think of their grandparents as nice and incompetent? As you said, those are the stereotypes.
Yeah, I think people do. And what Mike and I have been looking at in particular is tensions over resources in families, in the workplace, in society in general. So the younger generation and the older generation are especially likely to be in tension with each other over a variety of kinds of resources.
Right, whether it's money or jobs or all the things that feel like resources.
Yes, that's exactly right. So when my mother was 89, she was completely mentally sharp and organized, you know, half the retirement home's activities. But she found that when interns would come in to work with the old people, they would be very patronizing to them, and she really resented that, you know. So I once asked her if she, you know, encountered stereotypes in her life, because that's what I study, and she said, oh, yes, you know, sort of doddering but dear. And, you know, that's not fair, really.
Mm. Jay, I'd be curious about how you see the stereotypes associated with older people.
Well, I think there's a fundamental mistake that is made, especially by the young, and that is to assume that old age or aging itself is all associated with loss, decline, and decay, that it's all bad. And I've had this discussion with my students many times, all of whom, by the way, are in their early 20s. So they really, you know, they have no sense of their own mortality. They have no sense of their own longevity. Their only concept of aging and aged is associated with their parents and grandparents. And if you ask them, is there anything good about growing old, at least my students anyway have all said, no, there's nothing at all. good about growing old, and I then spend the rest of the semester, of course, focusing in on all of the good that's associated with growing old. I mean, I published a paper, a book chapter last year for the World Economic Forum, focusing in on all of the desirable changes that occur with the passage of time in us. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, there are bad things that happen as we grow older, but there are also many good things that happen. And understanding what those are and adapting to the changes that occur in our bodies and minds with time allow us to grow into older, many people anyway, to grow into older age with a very high level of functioning. And, you know, myself, my colleagues, for the most part, view older, healthy, very healthy older individuals as worth their weight in gold to society. We need them.
Do you, though, Jay, fault the media, advertising, I mean, all the ways that perhaps these stereotypes have some kind of impact on how people feel about old people?
Well, it's a combination. I mean, clearly the media contribute to this, but believe it or not, I've actually seen it within the world of science. So, for example, in some medical schools, in order to sensitize some of the medical students to what to how to treat older patients, they put these students through a program where they're exposed to what it's like to be old. So they put on these I can't remember what they call them, old, I don't know if they call them old suits, or let me see if I can find it. It's called an aged simulation set.
Yikes.
You're right. And so basically they put these devices on their body that restrict their functioning. So their knees don't operate as well, their hips don't operate as well, they can't bend over, they can't see or hear as well, and they say, this is what it's like to be old. And this is what they're teaching the medical students. And I really object to this. It's, I mean, you know, for some people that's true, clearly, but, you know, there are plenty of people, believe it or not, a fairly sizable segment of the population at older ages that really is not facing any of those problems, or at least certainly enough to be debilitating. And so it comes even from within the world of science, where we're teaching something that is fundamentally wrong about what it's like to be old.
Susan, looks like you want to add something.
I would totally agree with that, and I would add the psychological dimension to that too, which is that as people age, they get more cheerful and don't get hassled as easily. This is on average. Obviously, there are exceptions, but on average, people have a more positive outlook on life. And also, there is something called wisdom, which is accumulated experience. Now, you may not be as fast in terms of reaction time. Like if you're playing a game, a speed game with a teenager, you may not win. But there is no evidence in the workplace that people's abilities and productivity decline with age.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Susan Fish. She's a professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton University. On the telephone, S.J. Olshansky, professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and both of them authorities on aging, on stereotyping, on public health. And we want to know what you think at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Cayley Group supports WHYY, fostering and promoting traditional Irish arts and culture in Philadelphia and the greater Delaware Valley. The Philadelphia Cayley Group presents the 39th Annual Traditional Irish Music and Dance Festival. This year's festival features Tony DeMarco, Nuala Kennedy, and many other talented performers, and takes place September 12th, 13th, and 14th at the Commodore Barry Club, also known as the Irish Center. Tickets and information online at philadelphiacayleygroup.org.
The WHYY Connections Festival is back Saturday and Sunday, September 7th and 8th at the Great Plaza on Penn's Landing. Saturday rocks with headliners They Might Be Giants, Ben Queller, and more. And Sunday switches to the sound of Philly soul with the Soul Survivors, Sensational Soul Cruisers, and again, more. Both days are free and open to the public. The 2013 WHYY Connections Festival. Learn more and register online at whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, as Washington and the world debate the fate of Syria's Bashar Assad, could the conflict in Syria lead to a widespread regional war? Also, we've seen the effects of the drought and wildfires out west, but what about places like Texas? It hasn't seen significant rain since 2008. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and in this hour of Radio Times, we're talking about aging and ageism and stereotypes and discrimination. Our guests are psychologist Susan Fisk, whose research at Princeton University examines stereotyping, prejudice, and discrimination. And on the telephone is Jay Olshansky. His work at the University of Illinois focuses on longevity and health and public policy and aging. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-94. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Susan, I want to go back to this this description that you had early on about how other people or younger people look at older people as nice and incompetent. And that's a very limiting view, obviously, of looking at anybody, including an older person.
So, you know, all stereotypes are controlling by their nature because they are describing how other people's images of other people, and so if you're a member of that group, you walk into a conversation and that's like an anchor around your neck that you have to get away from. But stereotypes about older people in particular are distinctive because they're attempts to control the older people, right? And so if you, as an older person, act uppity and rebel against the nice but stupid stereotype, then what happens is that younger people in particular are more likely to overreact to that rebellion. And so if you step out outside of the box that they put you in, then when I say overreact, I mean they dislike you, they don't want to interact with you, you get punished for that. And if a middle-aged person does the same thing or a younger person does the same thing, they're not punished. So let me give you a quick example.
Sure, go ahead.
So if an older person says, particularly much older person says, I'm going to go ahead and have this optional medical procedure. It's going to cost a lot. It's going to consume a lot of medical care. They're penalized for that. A middle-aged person is not. A younger person is not. Now, you might make an argument for some sort of weird utilitarian rational thing for that. But then if you look at other domains, it's the same thing. Mm. So, for example, if you say as an older person that you're going to use social media, younger people are creeped out by that. And they don't want that. Middle-aged people, it's okay if they do that. Of course, younger people, it's their identity thing. So there's this kind of resource tension, both concrete stuff and symbolic stuff, that seems to get people agitated.
And agitated and kind of feeding some of these negative stereotypes that we have been talking about.
Well, yes. And so, you know, when we said the stereotype of older people is that they're nice but incompetent, that's like the default.
Yeah.
But then if you rebel against that, you're really, really punished because it's a controlling prescriptive stereotype, we call it. And not all stereotypes have that kind of prescription associated with them.
What are your thoughts about that, Jay?
Oh, goodness. Well, this, I'll be honest, is outside of my area of expertise,
okay.
So I'm going to leave this one alone.
Okay. But I think it's, I mean, no one wants to be put into a box. And obviously, when you are punished, I guess, for straying outside of that box, I guess you can be isolated, right? I mean, there's a price to pay for that, Susan.
Well, we see this in the workplace, for example. So if you think about what goes on in the workplace, people talk around the water cooler. Why doesn't that person retire? You know, the younger people need space to move up in their careers. Or in the family, at holidays, why doesn't so-and-so give up the family money and distribute it while we can still use it? So there's this kind of expectation that older people should step aside and make room. And, you know, one of the most common everyday stereotypes about older people is that they drive slowly. So, you know, get off the road, in effect. All of these are kind of about get off the road, get out of my way. You know, I'm on a mission. I'm younger than you. I'm more, you know, I'm moving up and you're moving down.
Well, and it is, and maybe because these are difficult economic times at Jay Olshansky, and we're talking about, you know, the unemployment rate, whether that sort of feeds the kind of scarcity model, I guess, that Susan is talking about. Do you have thoughts about that?
Well, you mean in terms of employment for older individuals?
Sure. Just the sense that there's not enough to go around, so older people need to get out of the way so that younger people can have their place at the table.
Well, you know, there has been a view that's been held by many for a while that it's actually not just associated with jobs, but just in life in general, that the old need to get out of the way to make way for the young. And that doesn't apply to just jobs. It applies to environmental resources. It's like move out so that younger folks can move in. And I think what it does is it generally discounts the value of individuals just as a result of their chronological age. And that, I think, is a huge mistake. And it's associated with, you know, our notions of retirement when people should be moving in and out of the labor force. And you know, when Social Security was created in the mid '30s, you know, 65 was relatively arbitrarily chosen. And I think our notions of when we should be going in and out of the labor force and when's people when individuals' value changes with time, I think has been associated with chronological age, and I think that has been a huge mistake. There are individuals who can be extraordinarily active and productive in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, and their age just is completely irrelevant. And actually, in many cases, age or the passage of time, in a way, probably for some, is an entrance exam into high competence.
Hmm.
And so, I just simply, for the most part, would not use chronological age to evaluate people, and I certainly wouldn't push them out of the labor force just as a result of their age.
Susan, I had scribbled down, you know, the elders, the healers. You talked about the wisdom that comes from old age. They're folks that are called old heads. You know, these were the mentors in a community that had something to tell a younger generation. Do we still have that, or is that gone by the wayside? Are we so youth-obsessed we don't recognize this kind of knowledge?
Well, we've done our work on stereotyping across a lot of different countries, and I'm sorry to say that the sort of default stereotype of old people is the same in three dozen countries,
really?
That they're kind of pathetic and useless, but not well-intentioned. Here's the one exception, is African-Americans talking about African-Americans. So that's the one community in which we find respect for elders. One place that we thought we would find respect for elders was in East Asian cultures, and to our big surprise, we did not in our own data. And so we're in the middle of doing a meta-analysis. Mike North is really running this, but looking at stereotypes of old people across the world, and it's actually worse in East Asia.
It's worse.
So that was not intuitive to us, but the data are what the data are. And in talking to people, the explanation that we've come up with is that in East Asian cultures in particular, you respect your parents, you respect your teacher, you respect your promoter, but you don't have to respect old people in general because it's too much of a burden.
Hmm. But it's interesting that African Americans, that's an exception to what you were just talking about.
Well, and I think it's because of the community role that they play. That's been very important in keeping families together and keeping communities together.
And that's Susan Fiske, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton University. S.J. Olshansky joining us by telephone, professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And we are talking about aging and ageism and stereotyping and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Jay, a quick question to you, then we'll get to our callers. When you look at longevity within families, does it run in families that if you have a parent that might live into their 90s, there's a good chance that you would as well?
Yes. When asked what somebody can do to increase their chances of living a long life, the first answer I always give is choose long-lived parents. And if you can arrange it, choose long-lived grandparents. So, yes, we know that longevity is associated with genes. We don't exactly know which genes are directly influencing duration of life, but clearly long-lived individuals tend to come from long-lived families. In fact, the longest-lived human was a woman by the name of Jeanne Calmon from southern France, and researchers studied her family history going back 10 generations in southern France. And I think the average duration of life in her family was somewhere in the 70s.
Wow.
During a time in which life expectancy in France was somewhere in the 30s.
Uh-huh.
So, longevity is associated with family history.
Does lifestyle play a role in any way?
Well, yeah, clearly. I mean, there's lots of things that we can do to shorten our life, and we exercise those controls all the time. We smoke, we become obese, we do lots of things that can shorten our life. And I've actually argued for a long time that the only control we have over our duration of life is to shorten it. Some people don't like that, but
no, right.
I think it's actually true. When you exercise, you eat right, you do everything that's right, you allow the body's longevity potential to express itself. There are people who live extraordinarily healthy, active lives and die in their 30s. And then there are people who abuse their bodies, like Jean Calmon, by the way, who smoked for 100 years.
Wow.
And they can live for over a century. So lifestyle does have an influence, there's no question, but it's basically allowing the potential for longevity to express itself. It's not allowing you to live decades longer than your genetic potential.
Well, let me see what Beatrice from Cherry Hill, New Jersey has to say. Beatrice, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm delighted to have this opportunity. I am 85 years, and it always seems to prove a startler to me that I made it so long in life, and yet I don't feel chronologically that old. I try to participate and always have a 2 cents worth getting into every conversation, listening to what WHYY tells me all day.
You go, Beatrice.
I have television, and I am a participant in the local community center, and I must be heard. There's something driving me, and I also feel that attitude, positive attitude, and a spirit for living is essential. I mean, it's just natural for me. I cannot say you can go to the store and buy spirit, buy spirits, but speaking of spirit.
Yes, exactly.
And essentially, being able to laugh at oneself, or offering a laugh to anyone, and regardless of who they are, is what I do daily.
Well, Beatrice,
and I'm a talker.
Well, you're clearly a talker, and I'm glad you called into the show as well. And I'm linking it to you, Susan. Your thoughts?
Well, I appreciate Beatrice's call because, Beatrice, you're an example exactly of what we're talking about, which is nobody should keep you down, you know, and you don't fit any of the stereotypes. So mm-hmm. More power to you.
And Jay, she talked about spirit. I mean, spirit and spirits, but she talked about spirit, which is just, this sounds like this is her personality and this is how she has lived her life.
Well, actually, you know what? Beatrice reminds me of Diana Nyad, who just swam from Cuba to Florida. And one of the first things she said when she came out of the water was, don't let age get in the way. Mm-hmm. It's just a number. And, it reminds me of something my father said to me many years ago. He said when he looks in a mirror and he looks only in his only at his eyes, he saw himself as basically a 29-year-old young man who, he said, I don't really know what 90 is supposed to feel like, but inside, I actually really don't feel any different than when I was much younger. And then, of course, he surveys the rest of his body, and he goes, "I don't know who that is." But inside, he didn't really feel any different. That's basically what Beatrice is saying: is that inside, you can physically and mentally function as well as just about anyone else at that age. I mean, clearly, as Susan had said earlier, you may not be able to run as fast, you may not be able to heal as quickly. There's things you can't do quite as well when you're older than when you're younger, but there are things that you can do better when you're older. And Beatrice, I think, is a classic example of that.
Beatrice, thanks for the call. Let me see what Shelley from Northeast Philadelphia has to say. Shelley, go ahead. You are on. I think that's Shelley. Yes. Go ahead. You're
hi.
On Radio. Hi. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. This is Shelley, and thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I listen to WHYY all the time.
You go
all day long. I was mentioning about. I'm a little nervous right now, but I'm mentioning about how I have cousins. I'm 61 years old. I have cousins that are in their 90s. I have people that are my age that are old. They're like they don't do a whole lot. My cousin's in their 90s. They send emails. They've done family trees. A 93-year-old friend of my father's fixes chairs and repairs them in the nursing home. And all these older people do so much, and they never complain. And all the younger people don't do a whole lot. They're like, I don't know what they're looking for when they're for getting older. They should enjoy their life at our age, 61, and see what all these older people are doing. And the older people don't complain. They just keep on going. And it's just so interesting. I hang around them all the time because they're fun to be with.
Well, Shelley, I appreciate the call to Radio Time. Susan, looks like you want to say something. Go ahead.
Well, I appreciate the call too, Shelley, because one of the points that you made is that there's a lot of variability at any age. And, you know, to treat people as if they are the average, or in our case, the stereotype, is simply unfair because there's so many different ways to be in your 60s or 70s or 80s. When I used to visit my parents' retirement home, I was really impressed by, you know, the variety of ways that is to be in your 70s or 80s. But the other point I'd just like briefly to mention is, you know, there are stereotypes of young people, too.
I was going to raise that. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. And so, you know, as we age, we don't want to box in younger people either. So I just want to raise that.
I mean, stereotype, I guess, is a kind of shorthand way. I mean, it's you can make a snap judgment about someone without really knowing who they are.
Exactly. And you know, it's a normal human thing to do because you can't get to know every single individual in depth and all their humanity. But it's something we all need to overcome because we make snap judgments about people on the basis of age, gender, race, social class. Mm-hmm. And we do that within seconds of seeing them.
And it's sort of a natural, almost like an impulse that we have?
Yes, absolutely. But when people are motivated, they go beyond their stereotypes. So if you're working with somebody, you know, in a long-term way, then you get to know the person and you find out what kind, you know, where on all that variability they lie.
Jay, about a minute before our second break here, but I'm wondering about the importance of social context. And I know as you get older, I'm an older person myself, friends die, you know, family members die, that there is this danger, I guess, of isolation.
Well, there's no question that's one of the more serious problems that many older individuals face is the loss of friends and the loss of family. And, you know, that's an inevitable consequence of surviving long enough where individuals begin dying in their 60s, 70s. And 80s, and that social isolation is an extraordinarily difficult problem to overcome, especially the loss of transportation, by the way. When people lose their car or their ability to go wherever they want, when they want, it really has a profoundly negative effect on them. So for those who are dealing with older parents or grandparents, they need to be cognizant of those kinds of changes.
And that's S.J. Olshansky, professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Susan Fisk, and she's a professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton University. We're talking about their work researching and talking about aging and ageism, stereotyping, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Door to Door Organics, an online grocer that delivers food fresh from organic farmers and local producers to homes throughout the Philadelphia metro area and beyond. More about food that supports health, community, and the environment at DoorToDoorOrganics.com.
On the next Fresh Air, some insights into cats. We talk with John Bradshaw, author of Cat Sense, how the new feline science can make you a better friend to your pet. Here's a tip. If your kitten is doing something it shouldn't,
you make the t-t-t noise that mother cats do when they're telling their kittens off.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The lawmakers have questions. Does the administration have answers?
My questions are about both the unknown and the known, and the fact that the administration's not talking about a lot of things.
The talk about Syria on Capitol Hill and throughout the nation, first steps toward military action, who's on board? next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
WHYY is supported by Pennsylvania College of Health Sciences. Applications are being accepted for an online RN to BSN program beginning this fall. More information online at pacollege.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Jay Olshansky and Susan Fisk about attitudes and stereotypes around aging and old age. As life expectancy increases and the population ages, what are the effects on society and on culture? And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Susan, you wanted to say something about driving.
Oh, well, so Jay brought up the problem of, as you age, being limited in terms of mobility and how basically depressing that is and disempowering, really. Mm-hmm. So one of the ironies in all this is that when Mike North and I were starting this research, one of the things we did when we were brainstorming about the tensions between old people and young people was we Googled old people shouldn't.
Oh.
It's shocking.
What, old people shouldn't what?
Well, the first one that comes up is drive, and that comes up in all different formats. And so, you know, you think about it, if, in fact, older people are more likely on average to be driving slower, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's the stereotype. Mm-hmm. Still, if you take driving away from them, you're imprisoning them, basically. But the other thing is that there are other weird things that come in under old people shouldn't, and some of them are truly strange, like use computers.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they care?
Mm.
You know, and the what people say on the internet about older people is way more hostile than toward any other groups that we Google.
Did you find old people shouldn't be having sex?
Yes. And that was, again, that was like, why do they care? You know, it's like none of their business.
Jay, I hear a knowing laugh from you. Do you want to add anything to that?
I'm not sure. I mean, you know, as I keep bringing up my parents because it's sort of the great example that I have, but I remember as they got older, I would ask them like all kinds of questions, and one of which is, are you still getting lucky? And and of course their response was, well, we're lucky every day that, you know, that we're with each other. Maybe they didn't quite understand my question.
Right, your euphemism there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's true that there's, you know, sex is one of those things that for many people actually gets better with age. Actually, here, let me give you a new stereotype.
Please.
To think about. If you could take all of the positive aspects of aging, you know, wisdom and intelligence, comfort in your own skin, perhaps better sexuality in some ways, and put it into a pill and sell it to people, the first people that would line up for it would be the young. I mean, these, you know, to understand and appreciate some of the wonderful things that happen to us as we grow older. Again, I don't want to present this Pollyannish view that, you know, everything is good and, you know, we need to recognize that things change and we need to adapt to them. But there are a lot of good things that happen and that we want those things to happen for the most part. And young people don't have it and they would like to have it. So there's a good stereotype for you of a pill, a simulation device that allows you to experience the wonderful benefits of being older.
There you go. We'll see if someone patents that pill and starts selling it. Let me see what Jeffrey from Kensington has to say. Jeffrey, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. My question is actually counter to, I guess, the direction of the conversation so far. But there's been a lot of evidence that's been published in The Atlantic and elsewhere in recent months about the diminishing opportunities for young people. Mm-hmm. And Vice magazine had published an entire edition of the magazine, I guess, in 2007, which was called We Hate Your Parents Too. And I was wondering the degree to which the guests feel that because of contracting economic opportunities for the young, that there's a kind of justifiable resistance on the part of young and middle-aged people to a generation that had a long period of economic prosperity, is now living longer, and wants to retain all the advantages of that prosperity.
Jeffrey, it's a fair question and an interesting one. And Jay, do you want to take that?
Well, you know, this links to an old adage that there's direct competition for jobs between the young and the old. And while I understand the problem of older individuals who don't move out of the labor force might be taking up a job that somebody just younger than them would ordinarily move into, and then somebody just younger than them would move into their position, and then it creates a problem down at the lower end of the age structure. So I would imagine that this does happen. I'm not sure that the young necessarily have rights to jobs more so than older individuals because they're old, and I also don't believe that there's that much direct competition between the young and the old for jobs. But I do acknowledge that there are going to be instances where this happens, and again, I'm not sure that even in these difficult economic times, that just because somebody is older, they're not entitled to remain in a job relative to an individual who might be moving into a different one.
Jeffrey, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Susan.
I would agree with all that and just add to Jeffrey that, in tough economic times, it's hard to blame an abstraction that these are bad economic times. It's easier to blame a person who you think is standing in your way. And so in that way, older workers become scapegoats. And I think that that's fundamentally unfair.
Thanks for the call. Jay, let me toss something to you. And this has to do with technology and aging, since you mentioned that pill to appreciate all the good parts of getting older. Should we also be thinking of robots and other technologies that frankly will help people in their older years live a more complete and full life?
Well, yes. Actually, there is an entire science in the field of aging that's focusing in on these types of issues, and I actually think it is wonderful science that is helping individuals compensate for things that change with time. So individuals that need to keep track of exactly what pills they're taking, for example, on a day-to-day basis, even for family members to keep an eye on or monitor other family members, technologies that allow individuals to, basically to function more efficiently during the day. I mean, if you had a robot that you could direct that would go, pick up laundry or pick something up off the floor so you didn't have to bend down, you're lowering the probability of individuals falling under those conditions, or even to carry things from one place to another in an apartment or a home. Those types of technologies, I think, are wonderful. And even at some level, I think the Japanese are working on essentially companions for individuals. You mentioned this issue of loneliness earlier. Well, it's possible that these types of robots may be able to not just deal with the physical problems that occur with time, but the psychological problems as well. So I think the technology is just at the beginning, but it's exciting.
But I would think also big knobs, big buttons, that's got to be, if we're going to develop technology, that's got to be part of the configuration.
Yes. Well, ironically enough, my son gave me for my birthday a couple of years ago some sort of remote control device for a TV that had these huge buttons on it. And I looked at him and I said, there's really nothing wrong with my eyes. I don't need this device.
Not quite yet, anyway, right?
Not quite yet.
Let me see what Beth from Wilmington, Delaware has to say. Hi, Beth. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I wanted to... Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Yes. I wanted to talk about my mom. Actually, my mother's side of the family, we have longevity. My great-grandmother was pretty well known here in the 70s. She lived to be 110, and at that time it was really unusual. And she got telegrams from the presidents, and she was quite a remarkable woman. And I see a lot of those traits in my mom, who is now 90. She is just full of life. She's a spitfire. She loves her iPad. She's in our neighborhood book club. She's obviously our oldest member. Some of our members are in their 30s, and at one point my mom, she does have a hearing problem, and she thought about dropping out, and everybody was just adamant that she stay in, because when we read a book, she brings a perspective that none of us have, especially anything that has to do with, say, World War II or something. She can say, well, I remember when such and such happened, and the younger people are like, you do? And it's just pretty remarkable that she just brings so much vitality, and she sings every day, and we just have a lot of laughter in our household, and she's just very enjoyable, to the point when my friends call, sometimes I don't get the message because they stay on the phone with my mom, and pretty soon I go, who's on the phone? And, oh, it was so-and-so, and I don't get to talk to them because they actually want to talk to my mother.
Well, good for you, Beth, and looks like you will probably live a good long life as well, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Susan, she talks about these intergenerational experiences, and I think for a lot of older people, they worry about being in retirement homes or nursing homes because it's people generally their same age, even if they act differently or behave differently.
You know, I really think the ideal retirement situation is a mixed age community because, you know, if you're in a retirement home and it's age segregated, then, you know, your bridge partner's dying all the time, and that's very depressing.
Do you want anything to that, Jay?
Well, actually, Beth raises a really important issue in the field of aging. And let me be clear. I think it is possible, perhaps even likely, that the children of long-lived people. I think she said her grandmother was 110.
Yes. And her mom is 90.
Right, something like that. So it is possible, perhaps likely, that the children of long-lived people age more slowly than the rest of us. So the word we use is senescence, which is the way in which we describe what happens to our bodies with time, sort of biological aging. And so if subgroups of the population are senescing more slowly, it means technically that, you know, I don't know what Beth's age was, but let's say hypothetically she was 50 chronologically, it would mean that inside she actually would be more like 40 or 30 or something like that. And you see this in the offspring of long-lived people, that they tend to look younger than other people the same chronological age. It's actually quite valuable information for insurance companies, believe it or not.
Believe it or not, yes, Susan.
And I would add to that, you know, Beth's mother is obviously cheerful and wise and energetic, and, you know, the only limitation that Beth mentioned was hearing. And, you know, those hearing cuts you off from the world of other people. Sight issues cut you off from the world of objects. And so, you know, that's one of the things you want to think about as you age, but what really gets you through are these, I think, personality traits and then also these age-related tendencies that most people have as they get older to look on the positive side, you know, which is really an asset, plus the wisdom and perspective.
Beth, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Margaret from Mount Airy has to say. Margaret, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I'm calling. I love this show. As a nurse, I worked with older population for many years and still do. And I'm enjoying this show with my 16-year-old son. And we're hearing about the positive aspects of being older as far as being living history, storytellers, maybe cooking better, and managing emotions better. And he asked me, well, what do older folks actually do better? Because earlier in the program, one of the guests had said that some activities are, there's less ability to do some activities and then an ability to do other activities better. So what are the physical and mental activities and perhaps workforce activities that they actually do better?
Okay, Margaret, thanks. And probably varies from person to person, but Susan, your thoughts?
It absolutely varies from person to person. But one of the things they find in the workplace that older people are good at is working strategically. So given that there's more accumulated experience and knowledge, they have access to multiple ways of getting things done efficiently. And if there may be limitations on speed of response, like reaction time, they learn ways to work around that. And so I think, you know, and I'm thinking of your 16-year-old son now, you know.
Who's listening.
Right. So, you know, he may not want to get advice from older people because he may want to learn how to do things on his own. But sometimes listening to people who have a lot of accumulated experience, you know, you can figure out ways together of doing things better.
Jay, anything you want to add to that? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think to the 16-year-old who's listening, who's your teacher? I mean, look, if you, and why do you listen to your teacher? Your teacher is older, is wiser, more intelligent, and you're learning from your teacher. And you really need to think of your parents and your grandparents as teachers, very much like the ones that you're learning from in school. And, you know, there's a tendency not to see them that way, but you really need to sit down with those parents and grandparents and ask the same kinds of questions that you might be asking your teachers at school. And then you suddenly realize, you know, your eyes get wide open. You go, oh, my goodness, my grandmother really does have a lot of information that is useful for me as a young person. So there's a tendency not to engage in that discussion. They really need to sit down and talk with them just as if they were talking to a teacher, and they'd be surprised how much they learn.
Margaret, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Just about a minute here, and I'll toss this first to you, Jay, which is I began with this question that the Pew Research Center posed, asking people whether they would undergo a medical treatment to extend their life to 120, and the majority of people said no. Does that surprise you?
No, and that's because, in general, people associate 120 with extreme frailty and disability. Mm-hmm. If the question was asked once again, if you could make it to 120 healthy and vibrant, would you feel different? And I'm guessing people would be, the number would be irrelevant. It could be 200, it could be, you know, 300. The number doesn't matter, just so people are healthy for as long as possible.
Susan, I'm giving you the last word.
I would totally endorse that. I think you have to look at older people as unique individuals, and you have to look at younger people as unique individuals. And if you operate on stereotypes, you're boxing everybody in.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Jay Olshansky, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Susan Fiske, thank you very much as well.
Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you with us. And she's a professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton University, has conducted and published a number of studies on ageism with Mike North. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out much more about this program. Stay with us. We'll be right back.